From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. It's nice to have you with us as we wrap up the week on Connections. Before we dive into this week's conversations, a quick note for you, our listeners, who may also be heading to the polls soon. Over the past few weeks on the show, we've had an opportunity to talk to a number of candidates for office. Those are lengthy conversations about issues. Our goal is to help voters get to know the candidates and their priorities and platforms. You can find interviews with candidates for county executive, Monroe County District Attorney, City Council, County Court Judge, Supreme Court Justice, and more on our website. That's WXXINews.org/connections. Back to this week on the show. We'll start with a conversation about police accountability. A referendum for a police accountability board is on the ballot for Rochester voters. The issue has been under intense debate in the community for years. We hosted a conversation with activists pushing for a police accountability board. They were joined by members of the Rochester Police Locust Club who oppose it. In this clip, you'll hear our guests talking about a specific case. Former Rochester police officer Michael Sipple was convicted of assaulting Christopher Pate during an arrest. Sipple is serving 3 years of probation. In this clip, you'll hear Reverend Lewis Stewart and Stanley Martin, two activists in favor of the Police Accountability Board. But first, here's the president of the Rochester Police Locust Club, Mike Mazzio. Evan asked him if, after watching the video of Pate's arrest, Mazzio thought the officer did anything wrong. Here's Mazzio.
I think the biggest problem they did wrong was try to put the case together or try to deal with it. I think going up to it, there was two different officers at two different perspectives. They never made the initial identification, in my opinion. The second part, what Mr. Pate did was identical to what he did to two other police officers in a different jurisdiction a few years earlier.
Did they know that about him? That wasn't relevant, right? What happened?
Well, it should be relevant.
No, I understand. It's relevant in the review on the whole, but in that moment, the officers don't know who he is. In fact, they think he's somebody else. So they're not thinking about a couple of years ago. Did they behave too roughly with him?
No, at that point in time, with what their own statements were and what they believed. And I guess, Reverend Sewer, you said you saw the video that showed Christopher Pate handcuffed and punched. I've watched that video numerous times. I hope you had a chance to...
Yeah, I saw it. I saw him handcuffed and punched.
Well, then there's where the concern of not having
by Sipple.
That's why we have the issues in terms of who's reviewing this.
When the officer is yelling at Christopher Pate, was the officer out of line at any point?
By yelling at him?
Some of the things that he said to that citizen, was he out of line?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. At any point, was that officer too rough with him?
Unfortunately, no. They needed to exercise the force necessary. In fact, I don't know if anybody in this world right now can actually say how Christopher Pate's injury occurred. And I think that's the point that anybody that took that video apart and analyzed it says. You can't determine that.
Mike, yes, we can determine it. Come on, man. Prior to that, he did not have an occipital fracture.
No, I'm not saying about an injury.
After that, he had an occipital fracture, which was also proven by medical records. See, the problem is, the reason why we cannot have this trust and transparency is because you're too busy trying to defend the wrongdoing of the cops. And that's what I see and that's what I hear. Now, you talk about Jones Park. All right, so why didn't they take that survey on Jefferson Avenue? Why didn't they take that survey in the northeast area of the city? Why didn't they take that survey on Genesee Street? I bet you would have come out with different results.
Now, hold on a second, Reverend. To be fair, I've got the data right here.
Yes.
The Urshad Altimer, whose reputation, as far as I understand, is above reproach at RIT, he and his team wanted to know what residents, and Jones Park is not an area unfamiliar with poverty or struggle. They asked multiple questions. RPD works hard to address issues of crimes, agree or disagree. RPD listens to what I have to say. I trust the police. I trust the police to do what's best for my community. 57% agree and 26% strongly agree. Only 16% disagree. So police are generally fair in the way they enforce the law. 25% disagree, roughly 75% agree. Police generally treat people with dignity and respect. About 74% agree, 26% disagree. So those are strong numbers. They're not 95, as Mike said, but it's 75% roughly. I mean, those are strong numbers of trust, about 3-1. And does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me because surprise me because of the area that it's located in. That area, Jones Park, I believe there's a Baptist church there, the Lake Avenue Baptist Church, I believe, in Jones Park area. That's when there were some problems going on between some young black kids and some of the immigrants a couple of years back. And so there was a strong police presence there, and I was a part of that in the meetings and trying to bridge the gap and things of that sort. But that's not the way people feel on Jefferson Avenue. That's not the way people feel on Genesee Street. That's not the way people feel in the northeast area of the city. There is profound distrust. There is suspicion, especially among young black people. And that's not going to go away until we see a coming together.
The reason we need a civilian accountability board was really just presented by Mazio. He's unable to say that the officer did something wrong in Christopher Pate's case. Sipple was fired. Sipple was prosecuted, and you still cannot say that he did something wrong. On video, you see him being attacked, and you still cannot hold him accountable. How can we trust you to hold anyone accountable when you can't even say that your officer did something wrong, and a justice system has already held them accountable for you?
That's not what I said. And to be fair, it was specific parts of what took place there.
The issues asked that, you twice.
Well, you know, do you know what DeBoer is? Do you know what a Terry stop is? If you don't know those, there was legal questions that had to be argued between a judge and attorneys. Yet a police officer and working is supposed to be familiar to the latest case law, to the latest levels. When I have Supreme Court justices tell me that they even render decisions on DeBoer that are then reversed, sometimes conflicting with other cases with similar fact patterns. Since Christopher Pate, I give you there's probably 10 or 20 exact same scenarios that have occurred based on certain information or something that officers observed. Stopped, and in a number of those cases, illegal guns were secured. Had this been the case in this situation, or it had been the individual they were looking for, nothing would have been determined to be wrong in that sense. That's what I'm talking about. It's not simple. It's you can't look at it and say this or say that. I'll say this. I don't believe that case should have went to a criminal court. It should have been handled in the internal process.
Next, when you think about solitary confinement, perhaps images from films like The Shawshank Redemption come to mind. One person locked up in a small, dark cell. But two men who spent years in solitary confinement in New York prison say that's not what most inmates experience. Jerome Wright was convicted of murder, robbery, and burglary when he was 18 years old. He takes full responsibility for the crimes and spent 30 years in prison, including 7.5 in solitary confinement. Curtis Griffin spent 28 years in prison after he says he was wrongfully convicted of rape. He spent 14 years in solitary confinement. The two men are now activists pushing for the passage of the HALT Act, which would limit solitary confinement in New York State to 15 consecutive days. They joined us on the show to share their experiences in solitary confinement. You'll hear from Jerome Wright, but first up is Curtis Griffin responding to Evan's question about what was happening in his mind after a day, a week, and a year in solitary confinement.
It's all over the board, depending on where you're doing it. If you're doing it in Southport, it's crazy madness because as far as your fellow prisoners, there's a lot of feces throwing back then. That's where they started throwing feces in the state, and that's where the original charge for a prisoner getting charged with it comes from. They were throwing it on guards, and they were throwing it on their fellow prisoners. And
people in solitary?
Yes. A lot of yelling, a lot of madness in prison, in Southport confinement, because that's like a big box statewide, and you got all kind of men, I guess, different statues, of, you know, maybe gang, non-gang, whatever. They're accusing you of being there. Some people didn't belong there, but it's a place, if you didn't believe strongly in God, I believe it could drive you crazy because of what's around you. You got guards that do some of the craziest stuff, like maybe spinning, take a food tray, they're going to give it to the guy. They get in a simple argument. Next thing you know, he opens up the food tray in front of the guy and spits in the tray. Or worse, maybe pull out his penis and pee in the tray, throw it in your cell, throw it in your face. Throw hot coffee in your face.
Did you find yourself losing any sort of grip of sanity over the years?
Well, Yes and no. I had a great parents. I come from a big family. They supported me. My mother was a very smart woman, so if I leaned on her about issues, she would really look into it. I was young, too. I would think I was 23 when I first went to prison. You're scarred for life, I'll say that, mentally. Because you're still left with the things you've seen or experienced. I've been assaulted in the box where guards have put on the full gear, has gassed me, accusing me of possessing a weapon from a tape recorder in which I'm on a visit. They must have smashed it or whatever happened because I'm on a visit. But when I come back, this is what they did to me. And they filmed it. PLS in Plattsburgh. Got a copy of it, sent it to my parents, and you couldn't have recognized me physically. It leaves you with a lot of things. Yeah.
Jerome, you spent 7.5 years. What was your longest stay?
2.5 years.
What happens in your mind when those days and weeks and then months pile up?
Well, like Mr. Griffin, I will say that I was blessed with a strong family. My wife and my children and other family members visited me regularly because they knew that if there was the inkling that you didn't have any outside support, that you could be abused in various ways. So the other fortunate thing is my mother and her infinite wisdom put me through Catholic school through all the way to my senior year in high school. So I had the wherewithal to read and write effectively and articulate myself. So I spent most of my time really helping other guys, reading books to them and with them, helping them to write letters, doing legal work for them and with them.
When you were in solitary?
Yeah.
How did you get the contact with them? Because there's a perception that the public may have that you're in sort of a hole and you can't hear or see anybody, with the exception of, as Curtis describes, frankly, the screams and the yells.
Well, and let's make this clear about solitary. There is, you know, people have the conception that you're in, like in the movies, I think it's Shawshank Redemption, or one of them, they're sitting in this dark room and they're all by themselves and they hear nothing and it's like tranquil. Well, all day, from morning to evening, they're screaming, there's banging, there's throwing stuff, there's yelling, there's everything. So it's not quiet at all. It's a cacophony of noise all day long. So sometimes, depending, like he said, with which facility you're in, they're not all constructed the same way. Some boxes have two people in a cell. Some have open bars, and some have full doors. So it really depends on what facility you're in solitary at, the construction of it. But solitary confinement is really about isolating people. I agree that there are times myself I needed to be segregated from the population, but I never needed to be isolated where I had no real human contact with other people, or I really got no therapy, no education. My family paid for correspondence courses for me so that I could keep my mind active. Most guys don't have that ability. Most guys in there, I'd say 7 out of 10, don't have a high school diploma or a GED. So they can't effectively read or write. They're functionally illiterate. So if a library cart comes by and you can't read, that's just an adding insult to injury. They give you a book, and if it don't have pictures in it, you feel like you even feel worse than you did before you saw the book. And if somebody else has to read it to you, it's a humiliating experience. It's a dehumanizing experience. The sense of isolation, the sense of not knowing sometimes if it's day or night, sometimes missing meals because you're not standing erect at the door, not getting recreation. There's a court mandated 1 hour every day you're supposed to get. There's sometimes weeks where you don't get out at that time because the officers feel like they're not running rec that day, or they're not going to let you out in particular. It is an abusive system, and it promotes abuse by staff. I mean, some of them come in there, I believe, with the right idea, wanting to help. But if once you're in that, It deteriorates staff, too. You know, corrections officers, and I met quite a few that are good. I would say the overwhelming majority of correction officers are good people. Then you have this cadre of bad actors who use prison and solitary in particular to get their jollies off doing all type of abusive stuff. And they have the highest rate of alcoholism, of domestic violence, of all the bad ills that the society have. These correctional have it was when you oppress people like you do in solitary, it has an invariably oppressive feel for yourself.
We'll end the week with a conversation with astrophysicist Adam Frank. He joined us to discuss a new piece he wrote for the Washington Post about climate change narratives being produced by Hollywood. In his piece, he argues that those narratives shouldn't let humans off the hook when it comes to their role in causing climate change. In this clip, he discusses climate change as well as related issues tied to artificial intelligence. Here's Adam Frank on climate.
The whole point of climate change, of switching energy infrastructures, is to now make it not inevitable, right? What I think is inevitable is that you trigger it. What's not inevitable is that you're
destroyed by it.
You're too dumb to sort of do anything about it. Yeah. I mean, that's what sort of separates the winners from the losers cosmically. The winner civilizations are the ones who recognize what they're doing and then figure out, like, oh, we got to change infrastructures so that, you know, we can have a thriving biosphere and a thriving economy. The losers are just, for whatever reason, can't get it together to pull back. So, you know, there's a certain way in which the laws of planetary dynamics and thermodynamics mean that if you're using a lot of energy, you're going to have a feedback. You're going to trigger an Anthropocene. Yeah, but the next step is sort of that's determined by kind of, you know, how quickly you can evolve your ideas and behavior.
And so on the AI, I know it's a separate category, but do you view that also technologically as inevitable?
AI is something I think very different.
We can pull back from that, you think?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, that is a choice about technologies. I mean, look, Betamax versus VHS, right? There have been times when we've made decisions about technology, you know, the invisible hand of the market. One way or the other, we've chosen certain technologies over other. Yeah, I'm quite upset about the idea that this sort of sense of like, oh, this technology just has to happen. No, like driverless cars. Who says that we have to have driverless cars? I mean, maybe that's a good idea, but like there should be a discussion. There should be some way we should get a vote rather than just having it shoved down our throats by people who stand to make money off of it.
Stand to make money and then maybe not thinking about unintended consequences.
Right.
There's a very smart guy named Matt Kelly who's going to be on the program on Friday who recently articulated a very interesting point to me. And I'm not sure Matt claims credit for himself, but he's relaying the idea that tools, whether it's a hammer, a telephone, whatever, are designed to make the human experience easier. So they're designed to supplement the human experience. They're not designed to replace the need for humans.
Right.
That's the difference with AI.
Right.
Is it enhancing what we do or is it replacing what we do?
Right.
And maybe that should be the dividing line.
And there should be a discussion about it. There should be, you know, digital technologies have transformed human civilization so fast and so profoundly that we need to really have the ability to step back. And that's what legislation and policy is all about. Step back and like take a break for a little while and think about these things rather than, again, it's these companies who stand to make a lot of money are telling us like, oh, of course you have to have this. Of course this is going to happen. You know, we've seen the detriment to democracies that have happened because of something like social media. So absolutely, we should get a say in how we want to proceed with these.
All right, down to our last minute or so. So for the people who read your Washington Post piece, and you ought to read Adam's newest piece. What's it called, by the way? I know you don't title these
things. I don't title these things, so I've forgotten what they said. I forgot what the title is.
It's about a new narrative or a new story on climate
right.
change. And for the people who read that and say, no, we need to have a reckoning. We have done terrible things. We are bad, and we are a cancer on this planet. What do you say?
I say that, first of all, that's wrong. I mean, I would argue that's scientifically wrong. And second of all, it's not useful. So, you know, there's this thing of like, you know, is whatever you, before you say anything, is it true and is it useful? And, you know, there's only so much you can only beat people over the head so often. All you're really doing is just re-traumatizing yourself every time you tell that untrue story. And you're not going to win any converts. You're not going to get the action you want by telling that story. There is a different story which is both true and hopeful about climate change. Doesn't mean we're going to make it. Doesn't take away the responsibility to act now. But it's a story that can carry us into the future because stories are were humanity's first technology. If you miss that point, you think you're going to do it all with just data. You know, you're not paying attention.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.